All right, so finishing up Unit G. Reminders so that to a different pointer there. This weekend is when ARE G and UCG will be due since we're ending this unit. So due Sunday. Otherwise, the selection of your organism contacts are due Friday. A bunch of people have already turned that in, so we'll start getting feedback back to you. Kind of talked about the framing here, and I've gotten some emails and sort of responded to those. But any questions about any of this? Do you feel pretty good moving forward? Great question. Only one person needs to submit. Because I've set things up as in Canvas as formal Canvas groups, then everybody will have the opportunity to submit, but once you submit, it shows up as a submission for everybody. And once I give a grade, then it'll show up as a grade for everybody. Any other questions? Okay. So we left off last time talking about Tragedy of the Commons animal style, with this kind of cartoon here, the capturing the basic idea of optimal group size, this idea that there might be positive externalities or the sort of public goods that you get from operating in a group. So might be that when you work with two wolves work together, they can take down bigger prey than they could if they were alone. It might be that as bats are together, they can get information about surrounding prey from the calls of other bats as well. And so that suggests that it might be good to work with others, to join groups with others, and there might be an optimal group size where it provides the best benefit to everyone who's involved. But a problem is that you can't keep others from exploiting beyond that optimal group size. And so if it's better for others to be in the group than being out of the group, where out of the group is down here and in the group is anywhere up here, then even though those in the group are getting this optimal benefit, they can't keep others from joining the group, and that will reduce the benefit until you get down to the largest group size here that you're willing to join. And that basically makes it so that being in the group is no better than being out of the group. And so that means the group isn't going to grow any bigger, but that means that any of the theoretical benefits you get from working together in a group are evaporating. And that's sort of the tragedy of the commons, but in terms of non-human animals there. So the way that ends up showing up is that most group sizes that we see in nature, if you can estimate this y-axis here, and you can then see what this y-axis looks like for individuals who are alone, and then also how the groups are doing. And what you find is that most group sizes in nature are in between these two. And it tends to be that you're closer to the socially efficient optimum here if animals have a way of maintaining or their group sizes. In other words, like they've got that resource holding potential where they can keep others out. But if you can't keep others out, if they can just join, then you tend to find group sizes that are closer to here. And that ends up being like the I-10 at rush hour. You can't keep people off. You could try to meter them coming in, but in the end, it might be so slow that it's no better than the alternatives. And that's basically what you see here, no better than the alternatives. That's where we left off last time. So any questions about that idea from last time? Okay. So yeah, with no barriers to entry, individuals are free to join. You generally can converge at this size here. But then the idea there is that if all of the groups are that size and individuals are there's other individuals out there, but they can't find each other, then what you're going to find is that there's going to be two group sizes that you observe. You're going to observe things that are close to this open access equilibrium, this kind of tragedy of the commons equilibrium, and then you're going to find the individuals who have stayed away from the groups that don't find each other, and they're going to be off foraging on their own. And so if we were to just randomly sample these animals, we'd expect to see this kind of bimodal distribution of individuals who are alone and far from other individuals, or individuals of this open access size. And so we're starting to get into something that looks like understanding spatial patterns across a landscape But in this case, we're not tying it to the landscape at all. We just know that there's just these group sizes. And so when today, we're now going to connect this to the actual sort of the distribution of food. And as animals compete for food and you've got these dynamics going on, then where do you expect to see which groups and which sizes? So that's kind of what we're going to be addressing today. And then we're going to pivot to then talking about, like, well, last time was all about exploitation. Effectively, today will be mostly about competition, but then we're going to close talking about cooperation, where the animals are actually working together to do better than they would on their own. So yeah, those are the two groups we're expecting to see: exploitation and isolation. All right, now what if you had more another alternative? So you've got these six animals that are over here, and they're in a group together, and then these two lone animals that are off by themselves, not in a group together. So eight animals in the habitat somewhere, six together, two separated and alone and apart. And then suddenly more area becomes available. So there's another opportunity to start a new group. And what, you know, might we think that's going to happen here? Well, if this group doesn't have anyone in it, then if you can manage to pull together like these two lone animals into a group of two, then they're going to do much better than the existing group that's out there. Each individual is going to do better than the existing individuals that are out there in this group. So much so that some of these animals might leave this group to join this group. So what we might expect is a movement to improve, where now your eight animals are split four and four. So you've got four here, four there. They're all getting the same benefit per individual, but they're now living in slightly smaller groups. And what's interesting here is that the equilibrium level up here is actually much higher than what they get by going it alone. So they've actually stabilized into a social outcome that actually provides benefits for being in a group that go beyond the benefits for being alone, very different than the tragedy of the commons. So, you know, what's going on here? And the big thing that's going on here is that there's you haven't sort of you have fewer animals than you have foraging opportunities. And so that means that because you can spread the animals out, then you don't actually manage to get all the way down to that open access tragedy level. So the fewer animals and the more foraging opportunities helps lift them away from how they'd get if they were foraging alone. Now, if you dumped more and more animals into this habitat, then they might start joining these groups. They might join this one first, and the next animal will join this one, and so on, until eventually you get down to the same problem we had before. But because we've opened up a new opportunity, we've created more space, then that allows the animals to distribute and actually do better than they were doing as individuals, and that to stabilize so that it doesn't go down to that kind of tragedy level, open access level. And that's the type of process that we're going to be thinking about today. So any questions about this idea that, you form group one, and then now you have an opportunity to form group two. As group two forms, then animals might rebalance, and then you end up getting two groups that are doing much better than everybody in the one group. Okay. All right. So where do we see that? What sets this problem up? And let's think about ducks on a pond here. So we've got these ducks are free to move anywhere on the pond. So they can move to their ideal patch. So what do I mean by ideal patch? Well, let's say that there could be somebody throwing breadcrumbs in from over here and another person throwing breadcrumbs in from over here. So the ducks can move anywhere. They could stay here. They could go to patch one. They could go to patch two. If they're in patch two, they could switch over to patch one or whatever. And so the question that we have is, how do they distribute themselves when they are free to move to their ideal patch? That's the key question that we're talking about here. What might that look like? So, yeah, so that's the, or we, might we get that in, if this patch is higher quality, might we get more ducks going to this patch than this patch? And how might we predict that distribution? So that is falls under habitat choice or selection, where we're using animal behavior and their social context combined with properties of the background environment, the habitat, to try to predict where in the habitat we're going to expect to see animals to be. So I'm talking about ducks on an artificial pond, but this could also be a wild population of, how many are going to be near a riparian, how many are going to be off on the edge, how many are going to be spread out over different shade patches, and so on. So there's a bunch of different ways we can generalize this problem, but ducks on a pond is kind of the simplest case. Just imagine throwing breadcrumbs at different rates. How do those rates predict where the ducks are going to be? Okay, so this is an example of interference competition. Or, well, I guess it's competition. And there's two forms of competition that apply here. There's interference competition, where we have an organism that restricts another organism's access to resources. So a duck goes and starts eating, and that is going to prevent another duck from eating because it's getting in the way, and it might prevent it from getting access to that. Versus scrambled competition, and that is when you have a finite resource that's available to all, but there's not enough of that resource for all competitors to receive a substantial share. So that's like the example where you throw a bunch of seed out and all the birds come running and they all try to get access to it, but there's not enough for all. And so those that come a little later may not get any of that seed. That's scramble competition. Those are two slightly different modalities of competition. They're both competition, and they both end up leading to thinking about these distributional questions about, well, okay, if there's this competition at play and they're free to move or maybe slightly restricted in the case of another animal's restricting them, then where are they going to end up landing? So that's the kind of the type of problem that we're modeling here. So we're going to start out with a simple case. Imagine if the two patches are equal. So equal in quality. What do I mean by that? Is there's like a little boy on one side of the lake and a little girl on the other side of the lake, and they're both throwing in breadcrumbs at the same rate. So you can almost imagine that every second they pull out a new breadcrumb out of a bag and they throw it in. So you get one crumb per second being thrown into this pond at both sides. So that's going on here. So you have to imagine, what is a duck going to do? Well, initially, let's say that we get a duck going to this this patch one. Well, they're going to get all of the breadcrumbs here. But as more ducks join, then that baseline five breadcrumbs or one breadcrumb per minute or one breadcrumb per second or whatever that ends up being, that's going to be divvied up among all of the others that came to patch one. And likewise, for the breadcrumbs showing up at patch two, those are going to be divided up. So initially, one duck can just sit there and just wait for the breadcrumbs to come directly to it. But the handling time of the breadcrumb is going to allow for another duck to get in there. And while one duck is maybe eating the breadcrumb, it might miss the next breadcrumb and the next duck will be in there. And now, even though the one duck used to be getting one breadcrumb per second, now is only getting one breadcrumb every 2 seconds because every other breadcrumb goes to the other duck. So that's what we're sort of picturing here, is that when there's one forager in the habitat, you get them going to one of these patches, either one. Once you increase to two, then you find that that other duck is going to go to the other patch because that's where it can get the breadcrumbs the fastest. The third duck comes in, looks at both of these situations. I feel like I'm telling a joke, like there's a duck at a bar or something like that. But the third duck comes in. And then it has to ask the bartender, how many blueberries do you have? It doesn't matter. But it goes in and goes down to the second patch here. So it looks, they're both equal patches. They both have one duck in it. So it's going to go to the one that it can get. Like, it gets, in both cases, it's not going to get the whole breadcrumb rate. So it goes arbitrarily to this one. So then when the fourth duck comes in, it's an easy choice because if it goes into this patch, it's going to get even less of a breadcrumb rate, but this patch, it's going to get the same breadcrumb rate that this one's getting. So then the fourth comes in, and now we've got two ducks in this patch, two ducks in this patch. All four ducks are getting roughly three, whatever this is, breadcrumbs per minute. So we can keep this game going through more and more of these things. And what we end up finding, we get five, six, they equal out here. And so what you end up finding is over time, the two equal patches, as you start adding the ducks in, you're always going to find populations that are roughly equal at these two patches. And across all of the ducks, None of them are doing any better than any of the others. All of the ducks are getting this intake rate, regardless of which patch they're in. All the ducks here are getting that intake rate. All the ducks here are getting that intake rate. So nobody's winning this game. They all are coming to some equilibrium where they're all doing just as good or just as bad. And because they're equal patches, we see equal populations at both. So any questions about this diagram so far? We're going to make it a little more complicated in the next slide. Okay. So then now let's make what if this patch is less high quality or less quality than this patch? So here you've got the kid on this side of the pond is throwing out one breadcrumb every minute. Over here, this kid is a little slower and is maybe, one breadcrumb every 2 minutes, something like that. So they start, if you're if you're the first duck, you're going to go to this one because now you're going to get your, so I'll just call it 5 breadcrumbs a minute. Because if you went to the other one, you'd only get 3 breadcrumbs a minute. Now, how's this end up happening? In reality, it might be the duck goes over to one, the duck goes over to the other, and there's some sort of reinforcement thing going on. So imagine you're learning stuff, and gradually the duck realizes the reward rate's higher over here. So the duck ends up going to the one that has the higher reward rate. So we're imagining all that's kind of settled out, and the duck has made its choice. It goes to the one that's higher quality. Well, what does the second duck do? Well, still, the second duck here. If it went into this formerly high quality patch, it would get this reward rate down here. So in this case, even though this is technically the higher quality patch, when there's another duck in it, it's actually better to go to this patch. So this is, in absolute terms, a lesser quality patch. But when you combine it with a population of ducks, this is the higher quality patch. So you get another duck coming into here. At that point, the higher quality patch becomes the winner for the third duck. And then at that point, it's interesting that the higher quality patch still is the better one there. So now you're starting to get 3 ducks in the higher quality patch and only 1 duck in the lower quality patch. So I keep this going until I get my 6 ducks again. So in this fifth duck, at this point, that's where the winner is going to be. And then finally, with the 6 ducks here, then what we find is that they go back to the high quality patch. And so across here, I find that across these 2 patches, so this patch is in absolute terms the higher quality patch. This is it, you get more breadcrumbs overall to the group. The group gets more breadcrumbs per unit time at this patch. But every individual across both patches is getting the same amount of breadcrumbs. The higher quality patch just attracts more individuals. So this distribution, which we're going to give a name, this distribution here explains how we can go from patch quality to this non-uniform distribution, which reflects the patch quality. So, any questions about what I've said here? Every duck is still, no duck is doing better than the others. There's no winners. It's not like these two are losers because they're in the low quality patch. These two are doing just as well as those in the high quality patch. But because there's more in the high quality patch is experienced by every duck to be identical to the low quality patch. So, we can't even really call it a low quality patch because you get, it's like if you have a really nice restaurant, everybody goes there, and it's really hard to get into that restaurant. So you've got the crappier restaurant, but nobody goes there. But at least you can get in and get your meal before the end of the night, and then you have plenty of time to do other things. So it's a balance. Who's winning there? The same idea here. These ducks, are getting the same amount of food as these ducks. In fact, these ones are getting slightly more. In these terms here. And we equilibrate with more ducks on the left and less ducks on the right. That's the theory. Okay, so this together is what we call the ideal free distribution. That's the new term, IFD. So when animals are free to move, when you have one of these resources that as more animals join it, it decreases the benefit to everyone who's already in it. And when animals are free to move among all of such resources, then we predict that they will equilibrate at this so-called ideal free distribution. We call these curves that I've been drawing suitability curves. And so the idea here is you say, how suitable is this patch given this population that's already in it? And so the suitability curves, they start high and then they get lower. And that reflects the rivalry in these resources. So they're non-excludable, rivalrous resources, and that's what gives them this shape. And then the way you end up figuring out what the distribution is you start a horizontal line, like you draw your suitability curves, and you start a horizontal line at the top, and then you see what the distribution would be if that was where the population was. So if I drew a line across here, it would intersect here, and I would get one duck in patch one and no ducks in patch two. Well, I know that I have more than one duck in my population. So you keep lowering this horizontal line until the sum of the populations in patch one plus patch two equal your total population. So you can see that as you start dropping this horizontal line more and more, you're going to get more numbers in each one of these patches. The blue patch will get more and the red patch will get more. But what we see is that the higher quality patch is going to always have more individuals in it than the lower quality patch. Now, it might be that once you get way out here where the suitabilities get really low, the difference between these numbers won't be as great, but this helps explain how things accumulate over time. That's the IFD, the ideal free distribution, and suitability curves up here. Questions about that? Yep. In absolute sense. Oh, well, that's a good question. So that the proximate mechanisms of this are open. So I don't think anybody who says talks about the IFD, rarely would we say that we think the ducks are doing any calculations. It's more that they're driven by the same sort of conditioning that we talked about, the same sort of like operant conditioning that we talked about back in the learning section. So it's like they have options to go to the left or they go to the right, and they might end up actually going all around the pond. And they just happen to notice that when I'm over on the left, I get more reward rate than on the right. So I tend to hang out more at the right. Yeah. Now, if you have animals that can keep out other animals, that can fight, that can say, no, get away, this is my breadcrumb. There is a modification of this, is outside the scope of this class, but I think I might mention it once, called the ideal despotic distribution, the IDD. And so you can modify these suitability curves to account for the probability that an early adopter will keep out new joiners, and then that will adjust to these distributions slightly. But it basically just makes the patch far less suitable to new joiners than old joiners, and it ends up looking like the same thing. You just have to modify the suitability curves. And that models the effect of aggressive interactions as opposed to coming up with some other way to add aggression to this. The IFD. Yeah. Okay. I've been making this analogy to tragedy of the commons. And in human systems, we often are just talking about a single resource, and it's unfortunate that humans use up that single resource. But in animal systems, we're often talking about smaller populations distributed over much larger areas. And so it's less so in human systems, when we talk about tragedy of the commons, we have a narrative where it's framed around the actions of an individual and whether they're responsible or not. And wouldn't it be great if the individual would kind of take one for the team and not join the resource and that sort of thing? And that's the narrative we talk about in the human cases. But in the non-human animal cases, it's really more about what alternatives are available. And what we're saying here is that you actually, you're the I mean, it's unfortunate you've got this rivalry that's going on here, but this, as you add more patches, then it benefits everyone because you get less competition for one patch. You spread the patches out, you maintain a higher quality, existence here. So it's like you can sit at lower patch occupancies if there's more patches. So for animal systems, it's less about the focus is less about whether the animal's doing what's right for the team or something like that, but it's more about how is the animal responding to the lack of alternatives. And that also gives you another way to reflect upon the human system cases. Like, is it right to say, like, oh, you just shouldn't drive on the highway right now because tragedy of the commons? Because somebody else is now going to drive on the highway if you don't drive on the highway. But alternatively, if you said, but if we had alternatives to the highway, then maybe not everybody would be trying to drive on the highway. And that's kind of the story here that we see in the IFD. Okay. All right. So the IFD is the social version of the matching law. So if you take a psych class where you talk about Skinner boxes and a longer version of the learning stuff that we talked about earlier in this class, then you'll learn that there's this thing called the matching law, where if you've got a bird in a box and you give you show it two lights and they peck on a button whenever those each one of those lights is on, and they notice that when they peck on the red button, they get food twice as often than when they peck on the green button, they will still peck both buttons, but they'll peck the red button twice as often. And that's the so-called matching law happening at the level of an individual. And so the IFD is thought as the social extension of that. If you've got a bunch of animals that know how to do this, that have a brain that can do this, if you put them all in a group together, then the thought is that those animals are going to, by virtue of all individually doing this, will end up collectively doing that. So the IFD is just a shadow of the matching law. That makes sense? Any questions about that? All right. Okay, so what to take away from that? So this is just a summary of the things I've been talking about here. This is a habitat choice model, ideal-free distribution. We're talking about a distribution when animals are competing for limited resources and they are free to move among those. Whenever they join that resource, the quality of the resource is going to decline, and we map out those quality declines in so-called suitability functions. And if you can plot the suitability functions, so you can go out to a pond and you can actually measure, like, okay, there's one duck there. How many breadcrumbs is that duck getting? All right, let's wait for them to be two ducks and three ducks and four ducks. So you can plot these suitability functions in real experiments, and then you can then put them on an axis like this and then predict what you'd expect things to be. And so from those predictions, you can go and test those predictions. And that's what I'm about to show you is some of the results from testing those predictions once we have a little detour here for a slide. So that's, and then another new term that I want to introduce here is Nash equilibrium, something that we're going to be talking about as we talk about more and more social stuff. And so an IFD is an example of this Nash equilibrium, which is here I define it as a set of strategies among competitors for which no competitor can make a unilateral improvement in their outcomes. What that means is if you're in a patch getting your breadcrumbs and you look over and you see another patch over there, if you decide to move to that other patch and you're already at the IFD and no one else decides to move, that's in my unilateral. So only you make the choice, you'll be better or you'll be worse off. So that's a Nash equilibrium, is that if everybody else continues to do the Nash and you decide to just try something else, you're going to be worse off. That's a Nash equilibrium. And that's what the IFD is. Once you've reached the IFD, it's better for the ducks to just stay where they are. If you experiment, then you're going to, if you're in patch two and you go to patch one, you're now going to be doing much worse than you were in patch two. And that's also going to, that does make things worse for everyone in the patch you're joining, but it makes things better for those that you're leaving. So it's a Nash. It also happens to be something called a Pareto equilibrium, which we're going to talk about a little bit in a couple of lectures. But the big thing I want you to remember is it's a Nash. So any questions about that idea of the Nash equilibrium, that this is a describes a social, it serves a distribution of strategies among a social system or among a group of individuals where those individuals are locked in, because if one of them moves and doesn't coordinate with someone else, they'll be worse off. Now, if you coordinate with another duck, like you could say, hey, I'm going to swap with you. You come over here and I'll go over there. You could do that and you won't be worse off. But if you can't coordinate, then you're going to be worse off. Okay. The Nash. You can have multiple NASH in a system. So this is so how many people have heard of the Prisoner's Dilemma? All right, so it's a useless game. So not something that is particularly helpful for thinking about systems. It's too harsh. Something that's a more useful game when talking about ecology is the stag hunt. And so a stag hunt is a coordination game. You have two players, and you imagine they're hunters. And this does apply to the wolf case as well. So imagine they're hunters, and so they could each hunter could decide to go after a rabbit, a hare, or a hunter could go after a stag, but they're only going to be successful at getting the stag if the other hunter also decides to go after the stag. So we can summarize the outcomes of this game in this little grid here, where we have one hunter's choice on the top, the other hunter's choice on the side, and the benefit you can think of as the number of calories the hunter gets based on what the other, based on what both hunters chose to do. So what we see is if both hunters decide to go for the stag, to go for the big ungulate moose thing first, or deer first, then they're going to get this cooperative outcome here where they both get, whatever this 10 units of some large, not 10 calories, something bigger than that, but they both get the highest reward. They get a very large reward going here. Now, if they instead, one of them decided to go for the stag, but the other one decided to hunt for the rabbit, the one who's going for the stag maybe is able to get the stag, but it's going to be using up so much energy, they're not going to get a reward, or they just don't get a stag at all. But the one who's going for the hare, not only does they have an easy time getting the rabbit, but the other hunter's not going for the rabbit, so they have an even a better chance of finding a rabbit because they're not competing with the other one for the rabbit. So under that case, the one who went for the rabbit gets almost as much as they would for the stag, not quite as much. And the one who went for the hare or went for the stag gets almost nothing. Now, if they both go for hare, it's actually not so bad. So if they both go for hare, then they both end up getting food. But because they're both competing for access to the limited number of rabbits, then maybe it takes them a little longer to find the rabbit. And so then they end up getting this competitive equilibrium down here where they both kind of win, but they just don't win as well as they did if they would have gone together for the stag. So in this particular game, both of these corners, stag stag and hare hare, are simultaneously Nash equilibria. In the IFD, that's one, there's one equilibrium, there's one social outcome. In the Prisoner's Dilemma, you might have heard about, and we'll talk about in the last lecture of the class, that one also has only one equilibria. But here you have two. So you can have multiple Nash equilibria at the same time. And so that's why it's called a coordination game, where really the outcome here is you end up getting the two players coordinating. They either coordinate because they have a way to both agree that they're going to work together, or they coordinate and that because they don't have a way to know that the other one's going to work together, they play it safe and they both end up going it alone. But they both do the same thing, and that's why it's a coordination game. And that's why we call this a payoff dominance. So if they can manage to agree that they're both going to cooperate, they'll both do better. But because if they have no way of signaling that they're both going to go for the stag, then there's a risk there. And so this one is less, they get less calories for this outcome for going for the hare, but it's less risk that they're going to end up over here. So we call this risk dominant. So these are two possible outcomes. One of them gives you higher mean. The other one, this is like a bet hedging strategy. You give up the mean, but you also have less variance. So there's less variance in your outputs here. So if you happen to play hare and the other guy plays stag, no big deal. You'll get eight instead of five. That's actually a good thing. But if you play stag and the other one plays hare, then you go from 10 down to one, and that's a big loss. So that's why we say this is payoff dominant and this is risk dominant, but they're both equilibria. If you can manage to get both hunters doing this or both hunters doing this, then it's a Nash. If one of them decides to change, they'll be worse off. Okay, so that's what we mean by, I just want to highlight in that for the moment, just to say that it is, you can have multiple Nash, It's an assurance game, and that the key problem is being sure that the other player is going to do the thing, like is going to do what you're going to do. So if you have a way to be sure your other player is going to help you, then just play stag. But if you don't have a way to assure that, then play hare, because that's just the safest option. So that's going to be an assurance game here. So stag, stag, socially efficient, payoff dominant, hare, hare, safer, risk dominant. And what's interesting in these games that have multiple Nash, in reality, you see mixtures of the two Nash. So when you have these in animal systems or in human systems, then what you'll end up finding is you'll get a group of animals working together and a group of animals going it alone. And that very much relates to the problem that we talked about before, modeled in a slightly different way with the kind of tragedy of the commons, where you get groups of animals forming these groups of six together and a bunch of animals just going it alone. And so you see this bimodal distribution. Well, the same thing is that if you can model the way animals come together with these types of tools and you find there's two Nash, usually you find there's some mixture where you're never going to see these corners that aren't highlighted, but you'll see, sometimes you'll see groups together, sometimes you'll see individuals apart, and that mixture is also going to be predictable from these payoffs. But if you're not sure about the payoffs, of what, you know, but the fact that you get a mixture is that. You see the same sorts of things like public radio. Like, you know, some people listen to public radio and some people donate to public radio. The donors to public radio probably listen to public radio, but the people who listen, but there's a bunch of people who listen to public radio that don't donate. And so that's a little bit like this, where you can think about those that are going in and donating, they are getting the benefits of that and keeping the resource available. But there's plenty that can exploit that as well. And you get a mixture of those two strategies in the population. All right, so big thing here, multiple Nash are possible. And we're going to see that more and more as we go through other social examples and later lectures. Any questions about that, about Nash equilibria or this idea of having multiple equilibria to these social problems? Okay. All right. Okay, so let's test the IFD. So this was an experiment done by Belinsky, sort of a famous experiment, where he had an aquarium full of these fish and these little daphnia, these little water fleas, that he could create droplets that had a programmable density of these the daphnia in them, and then drop them into here. So he could basically make it so that you could drop five breadcrumbs in on this side and one breadcrumb in on this side per drop. And they could drop them at the same rate. So it's like the breadcrumbs, but instead of throwing breadcrumbs, you're throwing little daphnia, little crustaceans into the water instead. And then he just counted how many fish would show up on the left side of the tank or the right side of the tank. And then he could do things like changing this distribution mid-experiment. So you see the start of the experiment here. So here you've got, before he started dropping things in, the fish were just all over the tank. So this is a fish in initially less profitable patch. So this is like a count. He was counting how many fish are over here in this initially less profitable part of the patch. And so he starts the experiment, and at the instant he starts feeding, you see most of the fish go over to the high profitability patch, but some fish stay behind. So you do end up getting, as predicted, one fish over in the less profitable patch. So that matches, that's good. It was a little bit like that, the producer scrounger game. And so then what he said is, okay, let's change things so that initially we squirt out these daphnia so that we would predict two fish here initially, but then in the middle of the experiment, we're going to squirt out twice as many here so that now we would predict four fish. And if you count the number of fish every minute or whatever, every fraction of a minute or something like that, then you find that they converge to the two fish, and then he changes it to the four fish, and then they rise up to the four fish. So it does seem to match what we see in natural systems. This, as long as they're free to move, they're not fighting with each other, they're not keeping everybody out, and it is reasonable for them to get from one patch to another, then it takes time. So there's this rise here is the fish kind of learning that there's a better reward rate elsewhere, and then they converge to that. So seems to work in this experiment. Any questions about this experiment? Okay. So then other experiments. So this is this is much closer to the motivating example where they tested it in mallards instead of fish. And so they did largely what I was kind of describing before. They created two patches and they threw out breadcrumbs at different rates and they saw how many ducks showed up. And maybe no surprise, when you have the two patches have equal quality, so we're throwing out 5 breadcrumbs a minute at every patch, then what you get is an equal number of ducks at patch one as you do at the other site. And so I'm just showing the number of ducks at patch one. So this is when they're equal here. Now then, in the middle of the experiment, as behavioral ecologists like to do, change things up, see what happens. So in the middle of the experiment, they make patch one less quality than patch two. So they throw in more breadcrumbs at patch two, less breadcrumbs at patch one, and see what happens. And the population of ducks declines in according to the predictions from the IFD. So seems to work with ducks as well. So fish in tanks, ducks on the water, IFD seems to work for both. Questions about that? Okay. The IFD. So when doesn't it work? Sometimes you see larger groups than expected, and that's when you can explain that by saying, well, maybe that aggregation is not just due to food. Animals group together for lots of reasons, for shelter, for safety, for mating, whatever. So there's all sorts of different attractors, conspecific attractors that can result in larger aggregations than you might expect. So and so you might say, wow, it doesn't seem like there's enough food in that area. There's like a whole lot of birds in that area, but they might be in that area because they're lekking for mating, they're just, there happens to be a safe area for them to roost overnight or something like that. So not everything's driven by foraging. That's why foraging optimizes for rate, because it's our way of saying you need time to do other things. The other thing is competitive advantages. And so I mentioned this earlier, the IDD. So animals arriving early may end up monopolizing a resource and preventing others from joining. So there are modifications of the IFD that are beyond the scope of this class, but I want you to at least know the name of this IDD, where you can take the IFD and adjust it slightly so that you can basically make it so that those who arrive later have even less than you'd expect by just the baseline resource rate. And so those who arrive earlier see a different suitability function than those who arrive later. And then that ends up allowing you to predict different allocations, and you can end up predicting things in the right directions relative to what you see when animals can do this. All right, so that's our IFD stuff. So questions about the IFD before we switch to cooperation, and we'll close out the back half of this lecture with cooperation. So exploitation was last time, competition and the IFD this time, and then cooperation is what's next. Okay. All right, so cooperation in terms of food. So these are native ants from the Phoenix area, Nova Messer cockerelli, ants that Anushka works with. And so these are, this is a piece of fig that they have never seen before. They're not from their natural environment. It was just peeled off and thrown on the ground, and they grabbed it, and they can walk in a relatively constant velocity and generally one direction there. And then here you can build these things in the lab. This apparatus was built here. It was covered in fig. So you just took a fig and kind of like just went all around the outsides of it to make the outsides kind of sweet. And they all joined together. And not only do they carry it in this roughly straight line, but they actually navigate around this obstacle. So they didn't even have to bump into this very much, or they move around it. So cooperative food transport. This is a crazy cooperative behavior, which goes beyond what you'd expect in like bats that happen to just be eavesdropping on other bats. This is not, two ants that are just trying to bring the same piece of food home for themselves, and they just happen to have aligned agendas for a short period of time. And so We note that in the ants, these are all sisters, and their only reproductive output is through a queen and through the brood that that queen produces. And so foraging for them is more than just their individual caloric needs. It is the caloric needs of the colony. And this selects for very interesting cooperative phenotypes like this one, really novel cooperative phenotypes. And here's a couple more. So these are Leptogenes, a different ant, an ant you can find in Cambodia. There's very few ants that do it this way. They form chains out of their bodies. So they find this big juicy prey item. They find it alive, and one of them stings it to paralyze it. And then they join together on the outsides, and then they like pulling on a rope. They then pull on each other, and then they form these really large chains that can carry these large prey items up hills and all of these sorts of things. So, a different way to do cooperative food retrieval. You can see a snapshot of it down here, the branching patterns that form. So, the food item is over here, and then you've got these multiple branches are all anchored at this one point. And then, like this carpet of, this chain mail of ants that is then carrying this thing through. It's out of a horror movie. So yeah, a lot of really interesting cooperative phenotypes that come from these being highly related individuals that are foraging not for themselves, but foraging to support genes that are, this is the extended phenotype of a queen. So what you're seeing here is not a group of individuals. What you're seeing here are cells of a queen that have migrated out of the queen's body and are now bringing food back to the queen. That's effectively what we're seeing here. And just like the adaptations inside your body are far more elaborate and complex than you'd expect a couple of ducks on a pond to be, this is taking the adaptations you see inside your own physiology and putting them on the outside. And you get these high levels of cooperation, which is pretty cool. All right, any questions about this cooperative food transport stuff? What's going on in these videos? So, another example that I want to point out here, so there's not going to be a lot of math in this side of it, but I'm going to stick with the ants here because it's this example again where cooperation is, you're really seeing social physiology. You're not seeing social interaction. And so, another nice social physiology example comes from fire ants, and it turns out lots of other ants follow this pattern too. And so, Ed Wilson, E.O. Wilson noticed that fire ants were really terrible trail followers. So, I think I've got some examples of that. So, what he would do is bait. So, these are three different ants that he put a bait up here somewhere, like here, here, and here. And he let them discover the bait and then walk back home. And while they're walking back home, they were laying chemical on the ground that would be like a map that other nestmates could follow back out to this trail. And what he found here is that after he removed the bait, then you would end up getting these paths of these ants following the trails that would be like wildly divergent. They would just kind of go everywhere. They would be roughly in the right area, but they were kind of all over the place, even though there technically was a chemical trail that should be there to guide them. And so here's another example of that. Here's the original bait location. And here are the locations that recruits were found at before they turned back and went home. And you find it's like the scattershot all over here. So they are not coming here and turning back. So initially people looked at this stuff and they thought, wow, these are just really bad trail followers. Like this particular chemical or this their or their maybe their sensory systems, think about the neuroethology of it all. And it's like they're just not very good at this. They're roughly in a ballpark, and maybe that's good enough for nature that they're just not very good at following trail as long as they get kind of nearby. But then, and so that's what we're saying, that there was noted that Wilson noted that actually fire ants typically are recruiting to live prey. Like they find a grasshopper that's still alive, and so they recruit to that live prey. If I'm recruiting to a grasshopper or a cricket that could move, I probably don't want to bring a bunch of recruits back to exactly the same spot that I was at when I left the group subduing it and laid the trail back to the nest. So maybe these bad trail followers here actually are adaptive. Because what this creates here is if you found the cricket here and it managed to jump away in any direction, there are ants already there. So the thought was that maybe actually this bad communication actually was predicting the likely escape area of prey. And that was, so this was actually adaptive here. And so, and what we've seen across these, so the idea here was that, an ant comes back, lays a trail, there's a bunch of ants here. The other followers come back to where they found the food, the prey item, and they get spread out in some distribution that's over here. And that distribution is, it looks like there's a bunch of wasted effort, but in reality, that prey item has moved, but it can't escape the ants because the ants are kind of in a confidence interval of where a moving prey item would be if it was originally found there. It's almost like the ants are not communicating where they found the prey. It's more like they're communicating where they're expecting the prey to be. So it's like they're predicting where the next step of the prey is. And what's cool about this is if you look at trail following species that don't forage on mobile prey, that forage on like seeds, things that are less ephemeral, things that will be there, they're very good trail followers. They follow the trail. They do not have this spread here. You see these spreads in ants that forage on live prey, prey that's still moving. So that supports the idea that it's not about ants being bad communicators. It's more like they treat the social information differently based on their expectations about the prey that they forage on, the prey that they're predators for. Questions about that idea, this idea that you're the type of thing that you're communicating with may change the nature of the communication. Or in other words, that you're not predicting, you're not saying where the prey was, you're predicting where it will be. And because of that, if you're only watching one ant, it's going to look like that ant is just really bad at following directions. When in reality, the ant is doing something that at the colony level, at the colony level, is extremely adaptive for the colony because it prevents the prey from getting away. Okay, so when I look at this, I see a diffraction pattern. So to me, I think about, is an ant a particle or a wave? Is the message that I kind of take away from that. So, if you shine light in at a slit, it ends up distributing in a, in a distribution here. So, we wouldn't ever talk about light in terms of just a single photon. We're interested in when you put a whole bunch of photons through here, where, what's the distribution of photons you get on the other side here? Well, that's the same thing here. So likewise, when you think about ant colonies, because they're so highly related, because they're effectively extended phenotypes of the queen, it becomes sometimes more helpful, more efficient to think about groups of them together as what we're studying and not individual ants. Now, the individuals, these are still individual animals. They have individual physiology. They all evolved from solitary wasps. So they've got waspiness on all their individual bodies, but now they've got these special adaptations that are so tightly coupled that it often doesn't make sense to consider just one of them. If you consider just one of them, then you're looking at this one and she's really bad at foraging. But if you look at this whole group, the group is very good at foraging. All right, so questions about that idea? Once you have cooperation, it really changes how you view the distribution of these animals. Okay. So tightly integrated social foraging sometimes requires rethinking individuality, where we might think of the colony as the single forager. So this distribution is really a colony-level phenotype. At some species, you get tight distributions. Some species, you get wide distributions. And it just like, this is Darwin's finches. This is the beaks of Darwin's finches right here. If you are a finch and you specialize on tiny seeds, you're gonna have a tiny beak. If you specialize on giant seeds, you're gonna have a big beak and big muscles to crack that seed open. If you extend that to thinking about these social systems like social insects, then if you forage on mobile prey, you're going to have large foraging distributions. If you forage on prey that are relatively static, you're going to have tiny. So this is the beak of an ant colony right there. Okay. And I think that's I think all I've got for you today. So, like I said, we talked about exploitation, we talked about competition and the IFD. The IFD is the big takeaway today, and then we talked about cooperation cooperation in terms of foraging. Now, we are going to come back to talking about cooperation more generally in the last lecture of the class, and then Bio 436 is a class where all 15 weeks are devoted on those sorts of questions. But that's all I've got for you. So I'm happy to take questions after. Otherwise, let's get you a attendance question. All right. And so a question I have here is what? Oh, let me think. So all right, well, this will be the easy one. So in the IFD, what does the F stand for? And don't forget, Tuesday is a holiday, Veterans Day, November 11th, so there's no class. Campus is closed. So the next time we see you will be Thursday.